Case 22-3488, United States of America v. Ronald Jacobs. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Young, when you're ready, you may proceed for the appellant.
Ms. Young, I see you reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may, is that correct?
Four, actually.
Four? Okay. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it please the court, Mary Beth Young on behalf of the United States. The government appeals a district court order suppressing a post-Miranda statement at the station house as involuntary. This court should reverse because none of the three requirements for finding a statement involuntary are satisfied here. First, the officer's conduct and statements regarding a potential search warrant were not objectively coercive. This court has held in Salvo that simply informing someone of the potential of a search warrant is not coercive as long as it has a basis. The district court here recognized that there would have been probable cause for the search warrant that was under discussion. Despite that, the court found fault with the detective's language, his references to dumping and tossing in describing the anticipated execution of that warrant. The United States submits that the detective's wording was not objectively coercive for three reasons. First, the immediate context cabined those descriptions to what was necessary to the objects of the search. The reference to dumping was directly linked to looking for those clothes. The reference to tossing was directly linked to until I find my evidence.
Yeah, but he said I'll toss the whole place and I'll, what was it, dump everything in the house out? I mean, he's basically saying I'm going to destroy your father's house.
I disagree, Your Honor. Dumping and tossing is not, the district court characterized it as threatening destroying the house, but what he's saying is dumping and tossing, which is marginally different. We know that executing a search warrant often does involve dumping and emptying drawers. His description may not be what any of us would have recommended he say, but turning to my second reason, the broader context of this interview, we see the detective using an informal tone throughout, casual wording, and this seems to be part of that effort to establish rapport through this casual tone. Third, even if we think that the detective's wording suggests unnecessary disruptiveness, voluntariness is not a matter of grading an officer's wording. The statements here, which ultimately are about how much of a cleanup is going to be required after a otherwise permissible search.
Can an officer's statements ever alone be coercive, such that it affects the voluntariness? Or do you always need more?
I think statements could be coercive, yes. I don't think these are. These statements don't rise to the level of the types of conduct that have been treated as objectively coercive. Even more plainly, they don't satisfy the second prong, whether any arguable coercion was sufficient to overbear the defendant's will. This court has identified several factors as relevant to this second requirement, and these factors all cut against the district court's conclusion. The interview was not unduly long. It was less than 1 hour until the initial inculpatory statement. Mr. Jacobs is mature. He's in his 40s. He indicated in the interview that he had 2 years of college. He was not taken by surprise. He had appeared at the station voluntarily after hearing that officers were looking for him. And importantly, He had received and acknowledged Miranda warnings at the outset of this interview. That is not challenged. As the Supreme Court stated in Dickerson, cases in which a defendant can make a colorable argument that a self-incriminating statement was compelled despite the fact that law enforcement authorities adhered to the dictates of Miranda are rare. This is not that rare case. Alongside all these factors suggesting that the defendant was not particularly susceptible to coercion, we have the fact that this conduct doesn't seem particularly likely to coerce. Again, given that no one questions whether a warrant could have been obtained, the arguable coercion at issue is only the overstatement, the alleged overstatement in describing the search. The difference in what the detective said and what he certainly could have said, simply describing the anticipated search, the fact that it would be very thorough, that it would go through drawers, that because they're looking for small items, including a handgun and a bandana, there's pretty much no space that it would not be appropriate for them to look at, that it may involve several officers, that it may take several hours.
Is it significant at all that from the standpoint of Mr. Jacobs, he should have reasonably then anticipated that the search was going to go through every nook and cranny in his dad's house because he knew the items they were looking for weren't there. They were at his girlfriend's house.
Yes, but, you know, in no way is that attributable or, you know, blameworthy on the part of the detective.
But it puts the statement as to what was going to happen at the house in context.
Yes, that's true. Given that marginal nature of the alleged coercion here, we don't think that second prong is satisfied.
But wait a minute. The detective, of course, doesn't know that the items are at the defendant's girlfriend's house. So I think this just goes back to the point you were just making. The detective isn't more culpable because he doesn't know what the defendant knows, which is where the things actually are.
No, and perhaps it's more relevant to the third prong, what actually affected, what has to be causative is the coercion, not some other aspect that the defendant knows in his mind.
My only point was it is relevant in the sense that it made the statements of the police officer more accurate, because that is what was going to happen.
That is what was going to happen.
And he knew it.
Yes, and look, the officer perhaps ill-advisedly is pursuing this casual tone. It's a reality that, in fact, if reasonably necessary, of course the standard is reasonableness for executing a search, searches do involve dumping things. Now, I mean, if he had said dumping your house to the extent reasonably necessary to satisfy the objects of the search, that would be better. I wish he'd said that. Finally, turning to the third requirement, the detective's tossing and dumping descriptions were not the crucial motivating factor for Jacob's statements. And the district court's conclusion on this prong was based on flawed reasoning. As our brief describes, the district court found a breaking point on the video, which the court relied on the fact that Jacobs was at that point putting his hand over in his head, or head in his hands. As our brief describes, he'd been doing that throughout the interview. That was nothing special. Also, that breaking point where the district court believed his will was overborne was after the initial incriminatory statement. Just a minute, the weapons, them is gone. Given this sequence, the district court's conclusion that the point where Jacob's will was overborne was caught on film is not supported by the video and does not in any event support the court's conclusion on the third prong. In fact, even accepting the district court's reasoning about the third prong, would still require reversal as to the first incriminatory statement, which preceded the district court's perceived breaking point. In closing, under this court's test, if any one of the three requirements is lacking, a defendant's statements are not involuntary. Here, all three are lacking. The district court's order should be reversed.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to first turn to the second and third prongs of the Mahan test, because I think those are the most easily for this court to dispose of. And those are essentially factual determinations. Whether or not Mr. Jacobs was affected by the coercion, and whether or not that was the reason that he later gave the confession, those are factual determinations that are doubly protected in this court's review. And I say they're doubly protected because they're reviewed for clear error. This court has to give credence to Judge Marbley's decision-making in that regard. And also, this court...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have to give credence to his fact-finding, not his ultimate conclusion.
That's correct. And the... when you look at the three-part Mahan test, the overall, the determination of all 3 points together is a legal determination.
What I'm just confused, what in your mind is, and I hate to take you back because I know you were going to get there, but what is the objectively coercive conduct? Like, looking at the facts as Judge Marbley found them, what is the objectively
coercive? The objectively coercive conduct is the threat to Mr. Jacobs' father's house.
So it's the statements alone?
It's the statements alone.
So if you slightly change the words, would that change it? If he said, I'm going to look through your father's house until I find the clothes, and I'm going to go through everything until I find the evidence, whatever it was, I can rephrase it, but... would that have made a material difference?
It does make a material difference, and I rely on the United States case in Ramirez, which is the case from 1988 that says that you can have probable cause to search a place, you can have a search warrant to search a place, but if you do it in an unreasonable manner, that can still amount to a Fourth Amendment violation.
No, I agree that they can't go and destroy your house, but what he said is, I will dump everything in that house out looking for clothes. And Ms. Young says, well, looking for a bandana, you're pretty much going to go through everything. And then he says, and I'll toss the whole place until I find my evidence. I agree, they're inartful statements, probably better not made. But how does that make it coercive? I mean, if that's all you got, you're struggling to get to coercion, aren't you?
So they were obviously coercive to Mr. Jacobs, and they were, and we can show that they were coercive to Mr. Jacobs because he breaks shortly after those statements are made to him. Now, it's what's interesting is where he doesn't break.
Wait, Mr. Shedd.
Yes.
And I appreciate your argument, but the breaking point can't be then we say that's coercive right before it, because what if he just said, I don't know, what if he came up with something else and then he broke? It has to be the statements plus in this instance. And what I'm asking is, what's the plus? If it's the statements alone, I think you got a hard road, right? Because we can look at those statements and make that determination the same the district court can. And what the district court said, and here's where I may disagree with Judge Marbley a little, and you can explain why I'm wrong and he's right, is that his experience cut in favor of coercion. But here you have Miranda followed by an intelligent, well-educated person who has experience in the justice system and is mature. This isn't an 18-year-old, as we find in some cases. It isn't someone new to the criminal justice system. All those factors in Mahan cut against coercion. And yet here, some of those Judge Marbley held cut in favor of coercion. So explain to me why that isn't wrong.
And I think this gets to kind of the ultimate issue in the case, which is, where is that line from when we're weighing the evidence to where we're making the legal determination of this is objective coercion, right? That's the whole point of this case. And I would submit to you, and I when I was preparing for this case, you know, what strikes me is we are looking at this case, reading the transcript, watching the video, but we're doing it in a courtroom setting, you know, not in an interrogation room, not being confronted by this evidence, not being confronted by this threat to our father's house. And we're not in the situation that Mr. Jacobs is in.
I think that's a perfectly fair point. I agree with you wholeheartedly, but that's true of every single case. And yet you're saying we have to defer to factual findings. And what I'm saying is, the statements are undisputed. The fact that he got Miranda seems to me to be undisputed. The fact that he's intelligent, mature, and experienced in the system all seem to be undisputed. And so we can consider all those facts and make that determination. And what I'm struggling with is how, in the face of our case law, when you're dealing with someone that's intelligent, experienced, mature, and college educated in part, after Miranda, to say, whoa, that's just those statements alone are coercive.
So you can look at those facts the same way that Judge Marbley did, but can you reweigh those facts differently than Judge Marbley did? And that's where I think the difference here is. So, Your Honor, you had said that you look at the fact that he has had these brushes with the legal system before, and you can weigh that differently than Judge Marbley did. Judge Marbley said the fact that he was a black...
But our case law says that.
Doesn't our case law say that experience with the criminal justice system counts against coercion?
It can count against it, but there is no basis to say... That Judge Marbley's...
Yes. Do you have any case in which we've said, oh, this guy is experienced in the criminal justice system, therefore that counts in favor of finding him coerced, this one?
This one, yes. It is this case, Your Honor. But I don't think that's a reason to discount Judge Marbley's decision-making in this case or weighing of that fact. The fact is the same. His prior experience with the judicial system... And his race is the same. We don't discount that. We don't say Judge Marbley got that wrong. Judge Marbley took that fact and weighed it differently than this court normally does.
Let's take the education point. I mean, we could say, is the defendant well educated? And we all know that we just list that as a factor. Is he well educated? And if he's well educated, that counts against coercion. You're not saying if a district court judge said, well, this guy has an eighth grade education, I'm going to count that in favor of him against coercion. You'd be up here saying that's wrong. He considered the right fact, but he gave the wrong valence to it.
Absolutely. That's the difference between de novo and clearly error. So did Judge Marbley clearly err in weighing that fact as for coercion? That's what you have to decide.
Well, but you agree that in the education case, you would say it's wrong as a matter of law because the law tells you what the valence is to the education.
I actually would disagree. I would argue that he clearly erred in making that determination. I don't think I could argue as a matter of law de novo, eighth grade means that he can't understand it. I don't think I could go there. So it would be still clearly erroneous. That's the standard. And you know, there's a lot that is said about the quote unquote breaking point in this case, and where was the breaking point? We don't have to prove, and Judge Marbley didn't have to decide exactly the point of where the breaking point was. But what we do know is that this threat was made, and within 6 to 8 minutes. He's confessing.
Let's talk about the threat for just a second, because Judge Marbley takes the words toss and dump and then converts that into destroy. Now, I think we all agree that if you said, I'm going to go to your father's house, I'm going to destroy the house, you can't do that. But what's wrong with toss and dump in a conversation between a police officer and a person who's had experience with the criminal justice system?
Well, and I think that kind of lends itself to Judge Thapar's earlier question, right? Because Judge Thapar contends that there needs to be something more than mere words. So under his scenario, destroy wouldn't even be enough.
I'm not asking the same question that Judge Tappara is about what if there's something more. I'm drilling back to the words themselves.
Sure.
Is there something wrong with, I'm going to get a search warrant and toss a house? Can a police officer say that?
No.
Why? Hey,
toss is
inherently coercive.
But no, not the word itself. But so I would urge you to take a look at page ID 393, which is the entirety of the discussion. I don't think you can pull out the word toss and say because he used the word toss, that's this. It's the entire conversation that he is having with him that causes the coercion.
So it's toss and dump. So we'll add them. We'll use both. Maybe one would be okay, but the two of them together is not okay. So is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is that if you take a look at page 393, what it starts with is it's 3:00 in the afternoon. It's early enough. I've already got the search warrant written up. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and I'm going to get the warrant. And then I'm going to go and I'm going to toss your father's place. I'm going to go through. I'm going to, you know, search it high and low. I'm going to, you know, and he goes on for a page about what he's going to do.
And I'm struggling with what's wrong with what he said, because it seems to me that's exactly what police do. And we've never held that to be a violation of somebody's rights.
Well, then what did Ramirez mean when it said that a Fourth Amendment search warrant can be executed in such a way that it violates the Fourth Amendment? That's got to have some meaning to it.
But that takes us right back to whether toss and dump fits in the category of violating the Fourth Amendment.
And Judge Marbley found two things. Number one, that Jacobs perceived it that way. And number two, that objectively that is coercion. That's what Judge Marbley found.
When you say he perceived it that way, hadn't he already made a statement about the guns prior to this discussion?
No. He made it after that discussion.
Okay.
But he did, to be fair to the government, he did make it prior to the break, which was also after this point. So all these statements that Detective Agee made are before he ever makes a statement about the guns.
So aside from the case that says you can't tell somebody you're going to go destroy their house, which is how Judge Marbley characterized these words, are there any cases that would help us, in your mind, determining whether toss and dump without the word destroy results in coercion?
And to answer your question, Judge McKeague, the one addition I need to add to answer well is that it's his father's house. And that gets us to the United States versus Finch case.
But that's where he lives. So
absolutely.
It's not saying gratuitously, I'm going to go destroy your father's house. You live in an apartment 3 blocks down. I'm going to do something bad to your dad. He lives in his dad's house. So.
And certainly Detective Agee may have said, he could have left his father out of it and said, I'm going to dump your house, but no, he didn't. He did bring his father into it. He intentionally brought his father into it to cause more coercion.
Because it was his father's house.
But
there's a different standard if the defendant happens to live with his parents versus living with a girlfriend or living independently someplace?
Yeah, so the difference in standard is again found in United States versus Finch, and that is that when you make threats to family members and those threats are not allowable under the law, that is coercion. And so in this case, had Detective Agee said, I'm going to dump your house, we would be having a different discussion than bringing his father into it, for sure.
Do you think we would be extending the law of coercion if we ruled in your favor on these words, dump and toss?
I don't believe so, because I believe that whatever the court's finding is with regards to this case, it is going to be limited to this case because of the way the court found.
Do you agree as a factual matter that police usually dump and toss, whether we like it or not?
When looking for small things, like a bandana.
Using those vernaculars, I would agree with that, yes, absolutely. But again, the district court found in this case, and there's no reason for this court to make a different determination as to the facts in this matter, and the import of those facts as it relates to Mr. Jacobs.
Well, the facts that the judge relied upon was that he said he was going to destroy his father's house. That's what the opinion says. And he was going to toss all of his belongings out into the street. And neither of those facts are true from reading the transcript and watching the video of the confession.
So the video itself is available to this court, and a transcript of the video is available at 53-1 in the record. We are happy to rely on what it actually says, because we think page 393, what it actually says is enough.
But that's what I'm saying. You don't find the word destroy or the words toss all of the belongings outside the house. You don't find that on the tape or the transcript, right?
That is correct. That is the district court's interpretation.
But you want us to defer to that as a finding that's not supported by the record.
Well, no. I would ask you to defer to it's in record 106, which is the district court's finding on the matter, and it's at page 949. And that doesn't include, that doesn't require the destroy. If you look at the end of that page, this gives you what the court ends up finding.
What page of the opinion?
It's, the page of the opinion is 6 from 16. And it's page ID 949. So that is the finding as to the first prong of the Mahan test, and that's what this court should rely on.
Even though the next sentence from the one you're looking at talks about no case authorizes the police to engage in the wanton destruction of property. I mean, we think we all agree on that.
Yes.
So we have to agree with you that toss and dump, which you concede happens regularly in connection with executing search warrants, is wanton destruction of property.
That is correct.
How can that, I mean, I understand how it could destroy property, and maybe it would be wanton, but why does one lead to the other?
But you cannot take out the fact that he made it about his father's property as well. That's the additional fact in this case. Unless there are any other questions, we would just ask that you affirm Judge Marbley.
Thank you, Mr. Schatt.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say a word about the standard of review. Mr. Schatt and I agree on several things about the standard of review. The ultimate question is reviewed de novo. Subsidiary findings are reviewed for clear error. The question of where the line falls is really where we disagree. I would point the court to this court's decision in Rice, W-R-I-C-E, which described where that line fell this way. Clear error regarding findings about specific events surrounding the confession. Independent review of, quote, how the accused reacted to the events and the legal significance of how he reacted. That's exactly what this court needs to consider here. We think that that is de novo. I'd also point the court to the Crumpton case, C-R-U-M-T-O-N, where this court was considering whether a Miranda waiver was valid and treated that as a legal issue, where the district court only drew inferences from, quote, the undisputed transcript and audio recording, but those inferences speak to the legal effect of the words that were said. So we do think it is de novo in this situation for all three prongs. Now, even if it is clear error review, if this court thinks that it's clear error review as to some prong, Mr. Schatt was arguing that the second and third prong should be clear error review. The United States would still be arguing, we think the district court clearly erred. As Judge McKeague has pointed out, on the second prong, the district court's conclusions turned on its characterization of this as involving destruction of property. At page ID 950, the court reasoned that by threatening to destroy the home of defendant's father, Detective Agee created an impossible bind. That is clearly erroneous. That is not supported by the transcript of the interview. Same for the third prong. The district court fact-finding about, to the extent you call it fact-finding, relied on this breaking point theory that was based on this head and hands, which again has been going on throughout the interview, nothing unique about this point. And also, he identifies this point where his will is overborne, that is after the first incriminating statement. So no way does the district court's own reasoning support suppressing that first incriminating statement that the weapons are gone. The court has no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We are going to take a quick break before the final argument, and so we'll